are listening to Red Eyes Creations Radio. My name is Henrik Palmgren and this is Internet Talk Radio broadcasted from the west coast of Sweden. Good to have you along today and thank you for tuning in. We are here on Thursdays and Sundays. You can listen to our programs through our website redeyescreations.com, R-E-D-I-C-E creations.com. And today we have a very interesting program ahead of us. We have Daniel Tatman from the UK with us on the line. And I actually met Daniel at the conference that we attended in Liverpool a few weeks ago. We bumped into Daniel the first day there and he shared some very interesting information with us about everything from ley lines, geomancy to architecture and the history of the town that he lives in. This is Bath, the old town in England, and Daniel is writing a book on the subject called The Bath Mysteries, and this is what we're going to focus on here today. From what I've heard so far from Daniel, what he shared with us, Bath seemed to be a fascinating place with its roots in the pre-Roman world of the Celts or the Druids, and there is so much more on architecture, history, masonry and other orders and secret societies that connects with his material on this old city. And we're going to go through this subject nice and easy. Our plan at this point is to make a kind of miniseries with Daniel on these subjects. He very recently got a blog up and he's adding new material all the time, so I do encourage you to take a look at that if you want to follow along from the beginning, so to speak. You can go to thebathmysteries.blogspot.com to check out his blog, and we're going to have that linked up also, of course, on our website, so you can find the link easy from there. And Daniel is very knowledgeable on so many different subjects, so it's going to be great diving into this here today. So with that, it's a pleasure to welcome you on the program, Daniel, and thank you very much for coming on Red Eyes Creations Radio.
Thanks a lot, Henrik. Brilliant to be here. It really is. It's very inspiring, a bit weird. Overall, it was brilliant to be here.
Excellent. Very nice to have you here, Daniel. And I think we're going to have a great discussion here today. What you shared with me so far is very interesting indeed. So, but before we, you know, dive into all of the things related to Bath and so forth, let's talk a little bit about you first, so we can kind of introduce our listeners to who you are and where you're coming from, so to speak. So, if you will, tell us a little bit about yourself and how you first got involved in this subject, Daniel.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I currently live in Bath, as you mentioned, in Somerset in the UK, and I've lived here for about the last 7.5-8 years. I was born here at the age of 4. My family and I moved to Wales, so I grew up just underneath the Brecon Beacons, which is kind of right in the centre of South Wales. So I grew up in Wales, and so I speak Welsh and English also. From a very early age, my parents were kind of members of what's still called now is the Jesus Freak movement. So they were kind of these lefty, liberal Christians, you know, quite open with their mindsets towards Christianity and ways of relating to theology and religion.
Mm-hmm.
So from a young age, I've always talked with my father and his friends and all of their kind of circle of friends who frequented the house, from kind of Greek Orthodox to Gnostics and sort of guys that run hippie communities in the middle of nowhere. So
right.
I had a very broad range of subjects which I was talking about with a lot of people a lot older than me.
Mm-hmm.
So I always had an interest in things of a kind of a more spiritual nature from a young age. Also, I was kind of inspired by hearing of my grandfather from my mother's side. My mother and my grandmother always used to tell me kind of the story of how he had gone to Africa when he was in his late 50s with a company that he worked for called Multico,
mm-hmm.
who made woodworking machinery. And they had a lot of very big factories around the world, and they had a base hub in Nigeria. And So my grandfather, he was the head of sales for the company at the time. Mm. And he went over to Nigeria. And they were building a small new factory to build some quite specialist machinery in a small place in the Niger Delta called Musaga. The whole principle of it was that they were going to build this factory and then bring in workers from a neighboring country to work there, because the area which they were going to bring the people from, they'd already been trained in using some of this machinery to make the other machines.
Uh-huh.
The joke of this was that they were going to have to be traveling about 300 miles a day.
Hmm.
The company didn't really mind doing this because they thought they would save money by not having to train up the locals to work in the factory.
Hmm.
And so my grandfather was there, and as a salesman, he had to be very involved with the community and the people in the area. So he got to know them quite well. And he came to the board of directors of the company with the idea that perhaps they could train a few key people within the locals of Musaga. And that they could then train the other men and workers within the village. And so they kind of thought, yeah, it was a good idea, but they didn't want to have any input or sort of impetus in doing it at all.
Mm-hmm.
And so my grandfather came up with the idea of actually taking them with him back to his house in Surrey, where he lived in the UK,
mm-hmm.
Taking them to the local technical college for kind of 6-month courses, and then doing as he said, bringing them back to the village to train up the other people.
Right.
And so he did this over about a 3-year period. He brought over men with their wives and their children, and lots of different groups that came over to where he lived, was Crawley in Surrey.
Mm-hmm.
It worked out well for the company and for the locals. And so, in the end, the workers weren't brought in from the neighbouring country. And my grandfather was very well respected by the people in the company because he'd saved them money and time.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
And also the locals of the village. And so, because of this, they gave him the honorary title of Okokuro of Musaga.
Mm-hmm.
And this is kind of an honorary chieftain title which can be given to somebody who's done a great deal for the tribe. They can be an outsider, they can be Chinese, white, it doesn't really matter.
Right.
But he was actually the first person in about 400 years in the mythology of the people, or the history of the people in the area, to actually receive the award. So it was quite a monumental thing in the late history of the African. he got this title, and obviously, this is great for a myth. You know, as a young child, I grew up hearing all about his work in Africa.
Sure, sure.
And this kind of philanthropic work, which worked out, you know, that he'd done very well for his company, and that he'd helped out this huge group of people.
Mm.
And so, I grew up, you know, idolizing the guy. I thought he was great, you know. And as I grew up, I kind of started to look more into the subject of what he was doing in Africa.
Mm-hmm.
Just before he died, about 2 years before he died, he was actually given a CBE by the Queen. He actually went to Buckingham Palace and received a CBE, which is a commander of the British Empire.
Yeah, huh.
And also, funnily enough, the Order of the Bath.
Huh.
You know, is the full title of it. He got this award, and so, you know, as I was becoming sort of 13, 14, 15, it didn't quite make sense why he'd been given this award.
Yeah, because this was a private company, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And he hadn't really done any work for the country that I knew of, but he wasn't particularly wealthy either.
Mm-hmm.
So the whole thing was quite strange. And what I learned in the years to follow was that he was actually working for the British Foreign Service overseas. And because he was head of sales, As I said, he was very much a people person. You know, these are the perfect people that the military intelligence and political intelligence groups like to come and talk to ambassadors and people of this position.
Right, right.
So they employed him to actually kind of get connected and get on well with the people there. And then when he was made this Okakuro of Mosugar, he asked some of the other tribal elders if he could buy some of the land.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, you know, he'd just done this great thing for the group and gotten them all work and things. And so, yeah, they all sort of talked amongst each other and decided that they would definitely have some land for the new chief, the new Okakuro.
Mm-hmm.
And he had a specific part of the land that he wanted. So it was about 40 or 60 acres part of this tribal land.
Mm.
And so, yeah, they agreed, no problem, and did quite a low price for him as well.
Mm-hmm.
And what the tribes didn't know was that underneath this land was huge amounts of oil.
Yeah. Mm.
And so, he bought this land at a ridiculously low price just for, like, farmland.
Yeah.
And so he kind of got this CBE for doing this so well.
So he was at that point, you believe, selling afterwards? Did he sell this land or let, you know, British Petroleum or something utilize the this piece of land to extract the oil?
What happened was he made the purchase on behalf of unknown interests.
Hmm.
And he was meant to get a cut of this money. It was meant to be something like £500,000, which at the time in the late 70s was a lot of money. It was more like $4 or $5 million.
Yeah.
So, yeah, he had this CBE. About 2 or 3 months after he got his CBE, he'd gone back to Nigeria and he'd actually contracted malaria.
Hmm.
And so he came back to Surrey with the illness. And actually died quite soon after that.
Hmm.
So he died before receiving the money for the deal and just after getting the CBE from the Queen.
And so you found this out by basically asking around in your family of what he was doing down there?
No, not really. I found it out by looking through. My grandmother kept a huge amount of photos and cuttings from newspapers from when he was the head of sales and he was going around the world and he was actually on Newsnight on BBC as well.
Mm-hmm.
When he got this title as the chief, the Okakuro.
Right.
And I've got some pictures of him, you know, with the presenter on BBC on Newsnight, all in his African tribal gear. it's a really fascinating story. And as I delved into it, as I said, I went to look through all of these photos that my grandmother had and cuttings. And I started finding all these references to Multico being connected with the royal family.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. And I started to find these pictures of my grandfather shaking hands with, you know, the Queen's husband and other sort of royal family members.
Right.
And so from that angle, then I carried on looking through these photos. There was literally thousands that I looked through over a couple of years.
Mm-hmm.
And I found everything from pictures of him at the lodge, in his local lodge in Crawley. With his white gloves and his apron, shaking hands with his friends, to pictures of him in little round mud huts in Niger, in Mosugar, shaking hands with the tribal chiefs with big bundles of money in his hand.
Really?
And the chiefs have all got bowler hats on, and kind of English canes and stuff.
Right,
looks like he's brought over a load of contraband for them or something.
Huh.
So I had this kind of mythological setting of my grandfather from my mother and my grandmother, which, you know, you can understand, because they didn't really see much of it or know about much of it apart from what he told them.
Yeah.
And yeah, over the years I've realised that he may have been doing this philanthropic work, but at the same time he was exercising the power of the state, you know, in
yeah.
the final sort of handover period where the British Empire had moved out.
Hmm.
They were moving their corporations in.
So, I mean...
So he was a major part of this in the area.
Yeah. And I mean, when you discovered this, I don't know at the time if you were, interested in, so to speak, in the more conspiratorial worldview at that point, but I mean, did your image of him kind of shatter at that point, or did you think even more, that this is really a great man, he's done wonderful things for the, British Empire? What did you think about it?
Oh, no, I mean, I was into the conspiratorial side of things, and I didn't really have any knowledge of Freemasonry or any of these things, but I was very political, and I was always very motivated by truth, and honesty,
right.
and love for the people. And the state, whether it be the royals or a government, is always the complete opposite of that. And I understood that from a very young age. I was taught that by my parents.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, this completely shattered my whole image of him. And it was from that point onwards that I realized the work that he was doing and living this double life, that my fundamental interest in Freemasonry started.
Mm.
Because he was the Grand Master of his lodge in Crawley. And so that was my primary thing, was an actual personal connection of my grandfather and some of the things which I'd seen had been in operation, but I obviously understood that they weren't all of his own making.
Yeah.
But he was being ordered. So, this was about the age of 16 or 15, I kind of realized that there was a lot more going on behind the scenes with these fraternities and chivalric orders and secret societies.
Yeah.
In connection with business and state affairs,
Hmm. Fascinating. So it's really what we're getting here, so to speak, is really an inside story of how the acquisition, as it were, of some of the resources are being gained, basically.
Absolutely.
Hmm. Fascinating. So what happened after this point? I mean, did you continuing researching Freemasonry and how, as you mentioned, of course, that he was inducted into the Order of the Bath, and that, the name there itself, of course, is a very interesting reference to the city of Bath. But maybe we shouldn't go there yet. Do you want to share some more in regards to your grandpa?
Well, I guess there's one other aspect of the story which I find absolutely fascinating, and it's kind of like the mythological aspect. In a spiritual sense, because what he told my grandmother was that when he'd come back to Mosogar in Nigeria, just before contracting malaria, that for about a year and a half before this point, he'd been getting cursed by the local shaman.
Hmm.
So everybody in the tribe seemed to really like my granddad.
Mm.
On a surface kind of exoteric level, but this shaman or this witch doctor, whatever you'd like to call him, really didn't like him. And whenever he saw him, he'd always do these little kind of dances and gestures and other things and speak to him in his native tongue. And my grandfather would always ask the locals, what's he saying?
Mm.
And they said, he's cursing you.
Oops.
So, he had this sort of ongoing rivalry with the shaman of this tribe.
Right.
And, he told my grandmother that just before when he had got back to Nigeria, just before contracting the malaria, that he'd had a very strange dream as he was coming back to Nigeria. He used to have an escort from the tribe who would meet him from the plane and would sleep in his room with him and guard him at all times.
Mm-hmm.
And make sure in the night all doors and windows are shut and everything like this. It's a very old custom, and so the guy took it very seriously.
Mm-hmm.
The guy often wouldn't sleep for sort of 20 hours and things. And so this dream that my grandfather had, he said it was a very surreal dream, where he kind of lazily opened his eyes and he was underneath a mosquito net in this hotel room. and he saw a huge spider sitting in the tree outside the window. And he said that this wasn't a normal spider. He said it was kind of like half a meter across, you know, a huge kind of thing.
Yeah.
And he said he kind of blinked his eyes and closed his eyes for a second, opened them again, and this spider was then inside the window on the floor. And the window was closed. He said he kind of did the same again, drifted off again, and woke up again. And this spider was underneath the mosquito and actually sitting on top of his chest.
Sheesh, okay.
So this was the last part of this very surreal dream that he remembered and counted to my grandmother. At this point, he actually had the malaria. And he was telling her this story in Crawley. And my grandmother still assures to me that he told her this story so many times and was so much in belief of it that she felt that it had something to do with it. Whether it was something which he'd believed so much and had felt guilt over some of his actions that it kind of afflicted him, or whether this was something actual supernatural that it actually occurred here. But yeah, that was one aspect which always fascinated me, and of course the whole role of karma kind of coming back, you know, how he'd lived this double life just before he got his payout for it. He's afflicted with malaria, gets a blood clot which then travels to his brain and kills him instantly. He had the malaria for 2 or 3 months, but one day the blood clot just went straight to his brain and he was dead within a few seconds. And so it's almost very much in keeping with his own karma that he provided for himself. So yeah, that was one aspect of it which always fascinated me.
Yeah, definitely. So, I mean, do you think the shaman at this point were up to speed with what was going on? Do you think that he knew that he was trying to infiltrate, so to speak, within the this community and gain the trust of the local tribe there?
I mean, I'd say from having looked into the whole kind of African ins and outs over the last sort of 300 years, not really connected to my grandfather, but predominantly the shamans or the wise men of the village absolutely understood what was happening. And they understood it on a multitude of levels, because, you know, they were realized multidimensional beings, you know, who did think about things on a very holistic level and were very intuitive. And so even if they didn't completely know the full story, even if they hadn't come into encounterment with these various Western groups, they could feel intuitively, I think, what was happening in front of them.
Fascinating, definitely. So there we have some background. I mean, do you know if this extends further back in your family, beyond your grandpa? I mean, it seems to be, at least right now, that in many cases this is something that travels throughout the family lines. And I mean, do you know if your dad, or even on your mom's side then, some other people have been involved in these kinds of close relationship, as it were, with the British monarchy?
No, it doesn't seem so at all. I mean, my mother, as I said, she was kind of this very lefty Christian.
Right.
So she always was kind of very wary of Freemasonry, because she understood it as a kind of very paternal, very nationalized form of ritual and ceremony and religion. So she was very wary of it. And so from my dad's side, obviously he wasn't connected to my grandfather. And there doesn't seem to be anything on his side of the family. But obviously my grandfather's father, and going back before him, it was successive for about 3 generations, as far as we know.
Interesting. And from what I've understand so far, because of your grandpa's involvement with all of this, you have actually yourself been able to gain access to some material, and even got entrance, so to speak, into looking at some of the libraries and materials in relation to the orders in Bath. Isn't that right?
Yeah, absolutely. While I was doing research for the book, I was actually helping the curator of Bath Tower Museum, young lady named Amy Frost. She was doing a book on John Wood, one of the kind of prominent architects that built up the Georgian city in the later periods. And so some of my research was used by her. Through her, I met some of the other curators of the museums and other people involved with heritage societies and the councils. And through talking with some of these people, I actually got round to somebody telling me that I should go to the Bath Masonic Hall in Orchard Street, it's located. And obviously, I mean, there's always, whichever town that you go to, if you can gain entrance to the Masonic Hall and go and look at some of their books, their literature, their pictures, some of their artifacts and antiques, you will find out a huge amount about that town's kind of heritage.
Interesting.
And so I called them, first of all. I called the Grand Master of the Bath Orchard Street Lodge. I was a bit wary of it at first.
Right, right.
But I actually kind of plucked up the courage to give him a call.
Yeah.
And so I spoke to him, and he explained that the lodge was actually closed at that time. They have an open part of the year and a closed part.
Yeah.
So he actually arranged with the caretaker who was looking after the hall for him to come down and come and show me around.
Yeah.
But this was only after the second conversation. And the first conversation, he was very wary of me and kind of didn't want to talk to me. But
really?
I gave him my grandfather's name and the lodge and his lodge number. So I knew that there was kind of this unspoken rule that if your father or grandfather or one of your male line had been a Mason, it automatically entitles you to at least ask to be a member. It doesn't mean you will be a member.
Sure.
It automatically entitles you to ask. So by giving the detail of my grandfather, it kind of opened him up a little bit. And he also said that one of the guys in the lodge knew my grandfather. Because he'd been a member of the same lodge in Crawley, in Surrey. I met the Grand Master and the caretaker. And they took me around the Bath Orchard Street Lodge.
Interesting. So, I mean, did the guys try to recruit you or anything?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
They did?
Yeah, well, first of all, they kind of checked. They kind of gave me their third-degree handshake, you know.
Right, right.
Just to see if I'd sort of tell them I was an apprentice or whatever.
Yeah.
And that didn't happen. And, eventually they said, you know, would you like to join? I must have been squirming in front of them because I didn't want to be too honest with my views upon Freemasonry.
Right, right.
But I wanted to give them a relatively honest answer.
Sure.
So I kind of just related to them that I don't feel that I need an intermediary of any sort, but I have my own center and my own grounding. And to give up to somebody else is like giving up my own thinking to somebody else. They were very, very respectful of it, actually, because they, I think, in a way, a part of them had wished they hadn't joined too.
Really?
The kind of look in their eyes when I was talking to them.
Really?
They kind of felt a bit attacked, in a way. You could see the look on the face. They were quite respectful of it. And proceeded to take me around to show me the library.
Right.
And to show me some of the books that you couldn't get in the library. In the town, which were written by Masonic historians and authors that had just written about general things through the history that weren't really around openly.
Interesting. So do you think they, at that point, withheld some information from you because you weren't willing to join, as it were?
No, I don't think so, actually. I think that, in a way, because I was so open and centered within myself, that they kind of sensed that I wouldn't be the right sort of person for the lodge anyway. After speaking with them for a bit, I think they definitely got the impression that I wasn't very fond of Freemasonry, but that I was more interested than I was judgmental.
Yeah, exactly.
I definitely think that they understood that.
I mean, that's an interesting point you raised there too, because that implies, so to speak, that you're thinking that Freemasonry is which it is, obviously, when you think about the concept of it. But what you're saying here is that this is something that is more it's a collective type of organization, which means that you hand yourself over to something which you as an individual don't have full control of. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, from every facet of it, really. I mean, wearing a uniform, you know, very much like school or the army or some sort of state provision.
Yeah.
Even the politician in his suit, you know. Any of these kind of roles where they give you a uniform, tell you ways to act, ways to move even, you know, ways to walk. You know, when you see the Masonic kind of marches, like the Orange marches around Northern Ireland, or if you see them going to large meetings at Great Queen Street, you'll see them walking in this kind of military file, all swinging their arms at the same pace.
Right.
Kind of, yeah, I mean, it's every aspect of it, in my mind, is about control.
Yeah.
And, you know, as most people that have looked into this, you find the work of Albert Pike. And, you know, I think he sums it up brilliantly when he talks about the concept of hoodwinking.
Yeah.
New admittance.
Yeah.
And so you just get them always wanting the next degree, wanting the next aspect of it, you know. So it's very much kind of like a drug fiend, but instead of a substance, they're offering you mystery.
Yeah.
You know? So they're kind of trying to get you hooked before you know what it is.
Yeah. And also, I mean, what about the idea that when you're going into it, you don't know what it is that you are signing up for, meaning that since you can't, okay, I mean, there are many books that are detailing the you know, the initiation, what is happening and so forth, but still to some extent, we don't really know, you know, what actually is going on within some lodges or how the, you know, how, I mean, they could, for what we know, I mean, they could even change some rituals right now because a lot of the information has been coming out, you know what I'm saying, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we've had recently this quite famous occultist in his field, Alan T. Greenfield.
Yeah,
he's been on a Cult of Personality, and he's been releasing a lot of books since he's left, as he would call it, his certain organization. but what he talks about in one of his books is called The Secret Cipher of the Euphonauts, and Jake Kotze and others have also talked about it. It's a certain page of Aleister Crowley's Book of the Law, which you can gain a cipher from it if you draw a grid over it. There's a certain ratio that you put the grid over this page of writing, and you can actually obtain a cipher from it. And Bishop Greenfield, as he likes to be called, has noted that if you take a lot of the names of different rituals or deities, or even the passwords of various mystery schools and certain degrees within Freemasonry, and apply them to the cipher, you get some very interesting output. You get references to older gods and very different gods than you think you're talking about.
Right.
So, I mean, this is just one kind of modern source who's kind of proving in a roundabout way that the more of these rituals that you learn off by heart, kind of like a stage actor, you know, that you're inputting yourself with huge ceremonies of ritual and magic, which you don't understand, which do have a specific purpose, but you don't know what they are. And you most probably never will within the Freemasonic societies, unless you have the impetus to look and find out about it yourself. And even at that point, there's so much kind of circumambulation, so much tossing and turning and umming and ahhing between this and that, that even after 40 or 50 years of studying it, you know, most people, even such as Manly P. Hall, he'll give you hours of conversation on Freemasonry, but if you asked him the blank question, what is it and what does it do, I think he'd um and ah again a little bit more. You know, I mean, and this is a guy who'd been through a lot of the rituals, obviously was given degrees honorarily, so he didn't have to do certain degree rituals.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, he was one of the sort of the most maverick talkers and writers on the subject of Freemasonry.
Yeah.
And, yeah, I don't think that he fully understood it.
Hmm. So it's, yeah, exactly. And, I mean, Pike talks about it too, of course, in his Morals and Dogma, that there are all the different kinds of level, and the game, as it were, is always to let the apprentice or you know, if you advance up through the degrees, that you're supposed to think that you have attained the highest level and the greatest secrets, as it were. But once you advance one level more, there's always a new name that's given to you, a new ritual, a new, you know, whatever, basically.
Yeah. So each time you're getting told, hey, you know all that mystical, spiritual, deep stuff that you learned before? None of that's true. This is the true stuff now.
Yeah.
This is what you got to drum into your head until that's all you can think about.
Well, I mean,
and then when you've done that, then you can move up. You know?
That's actually a kind of trauma in a way.
Absolutely.
I mean, might have spent even years at some level or at one degree, and then you end up finding out that, you know, it's all bollocks what you've been told, and you've been so into it, you know. So, I mean, sheesh. I wonder what it actually does to the mind of a person who's really, you know, 100% focused and dedicated to this kind of organization, just to find out that you've been, you know, basically fooled all the time. That's not a good sign to me, at least, you know.
Absolutely.
So, this is very interesting, and this is definitely worth, you know, thinking about. And it's interesting also that you mentioned that the guys that you talked to in this lodge then kind of looked at you in this way, that they've to some extent you could see some regret almost in their eyes, you know.
Mm, absolutely.
Hmm.
I mean, it's an age old theme which is brought out in every other film that comes out. It's kind of, you know, the manager or the worker who regrets not having spent more time with his family, you know?
Yeah.
Who regrets not having spent more time out with his dog walking, things like that, you know?
Yeah.
Regrets having spent lots of time with a load of blokes that don't really like you. going through sort of rituals you don't understand to try and get a little bit more sway in the business world, or to try and give you a bit more sway on a kind of individual will-based manifest level, you know?
Yeah. Hmm. So, what do you think, Daniel? Should we move into and talk a little bit about Bath, a little bit, you know, some of the overarching interesting, I mean, we could go into either architecture or some of the surface history, as it were. Is it a good bridge between Freemasonry and diving into the city of Bath?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, at present, there's seven lodges that meet in Bath in seven different halls. But there's also about six other groups which are kind of, they're referenced by the lodges as attending meetings there on their own nights. But there's not really much knowledge about who these groups are. Personally, I think that one of them is the Eastern Star.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not quite sure why it's not talked about in Bath, but there's a very large gallery called the Victoria Gallery, and it's connected to the Town Hall. And it's a very nice gallery.
Mm.
It has every month, it will have free exhibitions, some very good artists from around the world. And there's also always a main room near the top, a large rectangular red room, which is full of famous paintings by people like Thomas Gainsborough. He's a very famous landscape and portrait painter,
mm-hmm.
Kind of contemporary Georgian painter. And the whole gallery was actually paid for and dedicated to Queen Victoria during her reign,
mm-hmm.
by, and it says this on a plaque, by the women of Bath.
Hmm.
And, you know, I don't know how much clout the women of Bath have now, let alone in Georgian times.
Yeah.
But there are certain women that have more clout. You know, they're the women that are the wives of the Freemasons.
Yeah.
Who are in their own fraternal orders because they're so bored.
Yeah, and I mean, you mentioned the Eastern Star, and as you know, what we know about that right now is that both that's the lodge that both men and women can join. You know.
I think there's some which do allow men to join. I think more it's they call it cooperative Freemasonry. Which is the one for both. And I think the Eastern Star, maybe in recent years they've had to change some of their admissions, but it was almost always privately, you know, and purely for the ladies.
Right.
But that may have changed in previous in the years around now, because you know, the average age of the Masons in each lodge, you know, is sort of in the 70s.
Right.
And their numbers are dying off faster than they're growing.
Well, exactly, and that's a good point, because there's, I believe, in a way, constant reformation, as it were, of I mean, we can see it in religion, and we can definitely see it within you know, fraternal organizations as well, because if their main interest is to stay alive and you know, have new people joining, they need to constantly revamp themselves, because just as you say, I mean, the many orders are kind of, you can see these articles, you know, popping out so many times in different newspapers. If you do like a news Google search on Freemasonry or whatever, it's basically these recruiting articles, as it were, you know. They even giving you the lodge, you know, telephone number to call at the end of the article, you know. So,
yeah, I think that it's definitely, and this is part of the kind of the veil which has been brought up, and it's almost kind of a mistaken veil, because I think if researchers were looking into it better, as we know, the average lodge ages of, you know, established lodges is very old.
Mm-hmm.
But what you're referencing, and what researchers haven't talked about so much because they just want Freemasonry to go away, is that there are a lot of new lodges and new groups being set up all the time, specifically by younger people, for groups of younger people.
Mm-hmm.
And this is very much a part of this whole propaganda campaign which has come through with these films through Disney, various books from various authors, you know, all just piquing the interest in these orders. And yeah, this is a big aspect which is only now starting to be picked up on, and for a while people thought that massively the numbers were going down, but they are within the established lodges which have the older memberships. Whereas, as you said, it seems to be a kind of resurgence amongst, you know, the people. It's almost like a dichotomy that's been set up. You have all of these people that from 9/11 and from that kind of period have kind of shifted to the more anti the state, anti the government, anti military intelligence whole, you know, network. And then you get the people that kind of say all of those people are crazy and skittish and everything. And a lot of these time, these are the people that are the managers and are the people in positions of authority, you know. I know that from having worked at places and talked about these subjects with people in the staff rooms. Often the managers, who become this kind of father, paternal, Zeus-like figure over all of the employees, are very sort of damning of any of this stuff. And so you can see there's a definite division which is growing amongst the sort of younger people as well. You know, sort of the 30s, 40-year-olds. And so it's really fascinating. Whilst you've got this group which is growing, which is learning more and more about the machinations, the physics of power itself, whether that be through these fraternal orders, whether it be through politics, banking, all of these things, people really understanding that and realizing that this is quite a negative, oppressive thing. And at the same time, this group of people that are saying, look at all the technology, look at all of the wealth, look at all the holidays I go on every year. You know? So it's very interesting at the same point where we've got groups like yourself, you know, and very many others that are doing radio shows on these subjects. You've kind of got people actively ignoring it and carrying on living the way that they're living. And falling into some of the catchment groups of some of these fraternal orders. I find that a fascinating thing, which we're going to learn more about, obviously, in the next 10 to 15, 20 years.
Yeah, of course, obviously.
It's going to be a very pivotal time, it seems.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, it's been done on many levels. Of course, you mentioned movies. We have things like the Librarian. I don't know if you've seen that series. Very interesting. Then of course we have the Nicolas Cage movies. What are they called? The National Treasure, you know.
Yeah.
And to some extent, I think these and even the Da Vinci Code, if we want to go that far, that those are, you know, appealing. They're finding a new level. People are fed up with all the other stuff, and it's a kind of a new high. They can find something more interesting, you know, diving into a mystery instead of, you know, doing something else. And of course, again, it's the both sides of these. Just because you're interested, just as you say, doesn't mean that you're or want to go in and join the, you know, an order or, you know, fraternal organization. But just looking at it, at least, that's important, I feel, and just trying to realize what the heck is going on, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the subject of Dan Brown and the Da Vinci Code is, it's really very interesting because, you know, many people have speculated that he's working for this group and that group. And to me, it doesn't really matter in what way, because even if he isn't working for any of these groups, he's coming at this knowledge from a very capitalistic, materialist point of view.
Hmm.
You know, he's trying to sell many of these books on stuff which he knows isn't bang up truth and history, otherwise he'd sell it as that.
Yeah.
So he's aiming to make a lot of money. He's not aiming to get the message out. And so by telling this kind of a skewed version whilst gathering all this wealth and, you know, releasing the rights for a movie, he's kind of put over this very strange image of all of this information into the public mind. And it's going to take probably another good film or another few documentaries to cover the subject well enough and to go into enough detail with enough intrigue to be able to break that, as it's been so powerful in the mass consciousness.
It is. Exactly, and that's why I also can't help to kind of realize that there is something more else going on behind it. I mean, I remember Jordan Maxwell, we're talking about that a while back, and even the simple fact, you know, of just how a book ends up on the number one top-selling list, and once it's up there, of course, everyone buys it, you know? How does that happen? It's very interesting just thinking about these things, you know? It's so easy, if we think about it, for a big publishing company like that to just, through some kind of agreement with somebody, just putting it up there, and once it's out, everyone is talking about it and everyone wants to buy it, you know? So it's definitely worth thinking about.
Yeah, absolutely. And just to elaborate on the point that I made, it's the same thing with a lot of politicians and a lot of other people in power, as you can't know for sure whether they're a member of this order or that order, or, you know, involved with this group or what their overall stance is. You can get a rough idea. But what you can definitely see intuitively, emotionally, and intellectually is that these people are very greedy, very selfish, and you know, very, very centered on their own worldview, and nothing else even comes close to touching that, you know. And so, in regarding to Dan Brown, as you said, I mean, it may well be that he may have had words with some group. It may have even been that his publisher was simply, a connected man.
Yeah.
And spoke to somebody to check to see if he was allowed to publish it.
Yeah.
And this could take many different scenes, but what you can see for definite is the materialistic outlook that Dan Brown has taken, and the difference between him and Michael Tesserian,
right,
who was talking about things which are much more interesting, who was talking about things connected to real history,
right,
trying to read between the lines and not coming at it from this hyped up scam angle,
right. And also, I mean, it's because this is more a kind of a philosophical idea or concept around this, but it also, because as we've been talking about here, all these fraternal organizations are very much involved in business. They're involved in law, they're involved in making government flow in a certain direction, so to speak. So I mean, in a way, it's kind of, they're also coming from their own philosophical groundwork, meaning that if they are materialistically oriented, that is simply because they're part of a structure, an organization that has that at its heart, basically.
Absolutely. I mean, we can see it in most of the ideologies of the Western political world. They quite openly would say that they're Neoplatonic.
Mm.
So this implies, a very long lineage of consciousness, of perception, or at least sort of interpreted perception.
Mm.
Based on the works of these early philosophers,
mm.
which has been carried on through these empires, and is still here.
Yeah, yeah. Daniel, I think we'll do like this. We'll take a little break right here at this point, and in our next segment, I definitely want to go into and connect this a little bit more with Bath and some of the interesting places there. Of course, some of the architecture. And already, of course, people who are interested can go to your blog and check out some of the pictures that you have up there for us. Maybe we can look at some of these and go through some of that too, because that's fascinating. So Daniel, if you will, tell us your blog URL, as it were, so people can head on over there and check it out.
Sure. So it's http://www.thebathmystery.blogspot.com.
Mm.
You can go there, and I will be updating it slowly. It's a very young site at the moment. It's just been up a few days, so I will be trying to add a post or two every day, and slowly building up to the Georgian period, which is the kind of the epicenter of the work, is the geomantic layout of the city. And so on the blog, I'm going to be, after the introduction, which I've just finished, I'm going to be starting from a long way back and building up to the center.
Mm, very good. The website there again is The Bath Mystery with an S and then .blogspot.com. And we're going to talk much more about the Bath and some of the mystery surrounding its architecture in our next segment. But Daniel, also, of course, before we end things off here, I want to ask you a little bit about your book. You're working on it right now, as I understand it. Do you have any idea of when it's going to be out? Is anything like that set yet?
Yeah, absolutely. Quite a few people have been asking me about this.
Yeah.
Well, I was in a lot of minds about who the publisher was going to be, because I had backing from the Bath Heritage Society because of my work with some of the other curators. And obviously when I had meetings with the brethren at the lodge, I think that must have got back to the Heritage Society. So they were quite excited about the idea. But after taking into consideration how much I would have to censor some of the more occult or, in my book, interesting material,
mm-hmm.
I decided I most probably won't go with them. And after talking with yourself and a few other authors, I actually think it'd be best to self-publish.
Yeah, good idea.
Because I can have much more of a handle upon the work. I'd like to have control of every single part of it. I want to be able to design the cover. I want to be able to do the layout.
Of course.
And not have to worry about pleasing anybody else.
Exactly.
So it will be finished. Probably the compiling, the indexing and everything is on its way through at the moment. So hopefully it'll be finished within the next 2 months.
Ah.
And I will have all of this on my blog. I'll be taking pre-orders if anybody would be interested, because that would be great. So I could know, I could build up how many I would have to do the first batch.
Yeah.
It shouldn't be too long.
Mm, very good. We're going to keep people posted about that. And as we said, we're probably going to do like a mini series of this. We'll continue watching the progress as we're leading up to the release, of, as it were, of the book here. But Daniel, thank you very much for this segment. Stay with us, and we'll take a short break right here.
Brilliant, thanks.
We're going to continue our discussion with Daniel Tatman in our members section. We're going to talk more about architecture, Neoplatonic style, Palladian style, where they originate from, and how this connects with different ideologies. We'll also discuss Masonic cornerstone markings in Bath and other cities, measurements, stereometry, and much more.
Head on over to redicecreations.com. Click on subscribe to find out how you can sign up and get instant access to our member section. Before we end our first segment, I also want to remind you that if you want to join our forums, you can now register at rediceforum.com. Thank you for listening, and my thanks to producer Fredrik Palmgren. More fascinating research now from Daniel Tatman in our member section. This is Henrik Palmgren. Take care.